Sir Francis Drake. Within 50 years after Columbus had shown the way to America, Spaniards, Italians, English, French, and Portuguese visited the New World. All were hoping to find gold, but the Spaniards were most successful, for they conquered Mexico and Peru and won their rich mines of gold and silver. Every year, ships loaded with American treasure sailed into Spanish ports. England and Spain were not on good terms, and it was the special delight of the English seamen to capture a treasure ship. One of the most daring of these seamen was named Francis Drake. Even when Drake was a very small boy, he wanted to go to sea. If there had been no one to object, he could almost have launched his own house and sailed away on the ocean, for he, his parents, and a troop of younger brothers lived in the hulk of a great warship that lay just off the Queen's Dockyard in Chatham. When he awoke in the early morning, he could hear the little waves beating against the sides of the vessel. Then, as he lay and listened, the sound of hammers could be heard, the creaking of ropes, and the songs of the workmen in the dockyard. Strange, wild dreams had this little blue-eyed boy. "Someday," he said to himself, "I will go off on one of those boats that the men are building. I will fight with the Spaniards, and I will capture great ships loaded with silver and gold. Then when I come sailing back to Plymouth, the people on the wharf will shout, 'Three cheers for Francis Drake!'" With his mind full of such dreams as these, he must have felt disappointed when he was sent to sea with the skipper of a small trading vessel. There was no hope of capturing Spanish ships, for the little craft did nothing but sail quietly back and forth between England and Holland or France, carrying goods to sell in the different markets. Still, he was at least on the ocean, so he made the best of it and worked so faithfully that when the skipper died, he gave the young sailor the boat. Drake might have gone on trading if Spain and England had been friends, but Spain had begun to send out vessels to seize every English craft that could be captured, and Francis Drake's little coaster would have stood small chance of escape. So he sold it and went on several voyages on vessels that were larger and better able to protect themselves. On one of these voyages, he sailed away in the highest spirits. "When I come back, I shall be a rich man," he said to himself. There were six vessels in the little squadron. The admiral was a famous sailor, Sir John Hawkins. Drake was put in command of the Judith. They sailed to the African coast, seized some black men, carried them to the Spanish settlements, and sold them as slaves. The ships were loaded with the gold and pearls which had been received in payment and started for England. Before they had sailed many days, they were so disabled by a storm that the admiral had to put in the Spanish port of Veracruz for repairs. There, in the harbor, were 12 great Spanish ships loaded with gold and silver. On the following day, 12 more arrived with the same sort of cargo. Hawkins and Drake said to the Spaniards, "We wish to refit our vessels and sail for home. If you will agree not to interfere with us, we will not touch your ships." The agreement was made, and for 3 days everything was quiet and friendly. Then, in spite of all their promises, the Spaniards suddenly made a fierce attack on the English vessels. Hawkins in the Minion and Drake in the Judith succeeded in escaping and making their way to England, but the pearls and gold went to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Drake reached home before the admiral and told his story of the treachery of the Spaniards. He had lost all that he had invested, and he appealed to the Queen to oblige Spain to make his loss good. Queen Elizabeth was not sure that England was strong enough to fight with Spain, so she did nothing for him. Then Drake took matters into his own hands. He went on voyage after voyage. He robbed Spanish colonies, and he took Spanish gold and jewels wherever he could find them. King Philip of Spain complained bitterly of the master thief of the Western world, but the Queen did not punish her seamen. On one of his voyages, Drake had landed on the Isthmus of Panama and made his way across it. When he reached the highest point of the isthmus, the Indians, who were his guides, showed him a tall tree. "Climb it," they said, and Drake obeyed eagerly. Steps had been cut into the tree, and soon he was on a little platform which was supported by the branches. Behold, a vast ocean was on either hand. "Behind you is the North Sea from which you have come," said his guides, "and before you is the South Sea." "Into which I will go," said Drake to himself. "May God give me leave and life to sail on an English ship on that sea but once," he cried. Year after year passed. One night a messenger came to Drake to say, "Her Majesty the Queen wishes to see you." The bluff sailor and the mighty sovereign had a long talk. Not many months later, 5 ships sailed out of Plymouth Harbor under Drake's command. They were not only fully armed, but they were provided with all the luxuries of the time. The fragrance of costly perfumes floated back to the crowds on the wharf. The furnishings of the admiral's cabin were of the richest satin and velvet. The table was spread with the finest of linen and laid with dishes of silver and gold. When the commander was ready to dine, the sound of violins was heard, and the music continued until the meal was ended. As the ship sailed away, some people on the wharf said, "I hope his voyage to Egypt will be a success." Others retorted, "Those ships will never see Egypt. They are going to trade and explore in the South Sea." Still others smiled knowingly and said to themselves, "The exploring will be searching for Spanish ships, and the trading will be seizing Spanish treasures." This last was exactly what Drake meant to do, but if a hint of his plans had reached Spain, the treasures would have been safely hidden. 60 years earlier, Magellan had sailed through the strait that bears his name, but no one else had ever succeeded in making the voyage. "What Magellan did, I can do," thought Drake, and he sailed down the coast of South America and steered boldly into the strait. 2 vessels had already been broken up as unseaworthy. A fierce tempest scattered the other 3. 1 sank, and the commander of the 2nd went home in despair. For 52 days, Drake was driven about by terrible storms. When the gales ceased, he found that his vessel was lying among a group of islands. He landed on the most southern and walked alone to its farthest extremity. There he stood, looking at the breakers rolling up on the shore. Before him the waters of the Atlantic and the Pacific mingled. He threw himself on the ground, clasped his arms about a jagged rock, and said to himself, "I am the only man in the world who has ever been so far south." The exciting part of the voyage was yet to come. Some of the treasure that the Spaniards took from Peru was carried to Panama by land, and some was loaded on shipboard and carried up the coast to the isthmus. One of these ships, with a cargo of good yellow gold, was lying in Valparaiso. The crew caught sight of white sails coming toward them. "See," they cried, "there's one of our ships. Get the wine ready, and we will make a night of it." The flags were run up, and the drums were beaten in welcome, but almost before the Spaniards had discovered their mistake, the Englishmen had seized the ship and fastened the men under the hatches. So it was that the Golden Hind went merrily up the coast, now and then seizing a vessel full of provisions or valuables. One day some of the men went ashore, and there they came across a man who had laid down his burden of silver bars and fallen asleep. "Pardon us, sir," they said with mock politeness in the best Spanish they could muster. "We are grieved to disturb you, but we will make amends. We will relieve you of the weight of the silver, and then your journey will be less wearisome." Drake was aiming for Lima, where he expected to find vessels worth capturing. The vessels were there, but every ounce of treasure had either been taken ashore or carried away 2 weeks earlier on a ship which was known among sailors as the Spitfire. "We will catch her," thought Drake, and he set out in pursuit. He captured 1 ship. "Where is the Spitfire?" he demanded. 10 days ahead," was the reply. The next capture said, 5 days, and the next, 2 days. Then Drake swung before the eyes of the sailors a golden chain that gleamed and glittered in the sunshine. "This goes to the man who sees the Spitfire first," he said. A boy, Drake's own nephew was the fortunate one to win the reward. The Spitfire yielded without a blow, and such a cargo went into the hold of the Golden Hind as no English vessel had ever carried before. 13 chests of Spanish dollars, 80 pounds of gold, 26 tons of silver, and more jewels than could be counted. Two or three other vessels were captured, but they proved to be loaded with silk and linen and china, and there was little room for such trifles in the treasure-laden hold. "I think Her Majesty will be satisfied with what I have done," said Drake to himself, "and now we will make for home." The Spaniards were keeping close watch of the strait, but that did not trouble Drake in the least, for he had another plan in his mind. Mariners believed that there was a northern channel which led from the Pacific to the Atlantic. The Northwest Passage, they called it, and Drake meant to find this passage and sail home through it. Straight north went the gold-laden vessel. The weather grew colder and colder, and when he was as far north as Vancouver Island, he saw that it was of no use to try to go farther. So he determined to reach England by steering west across the Pacific and rounding the Cape of Good Hope. He went south again and entered a harbor near where San Francisco now stands. The cliffs were white like those of England. "In the name of Queen Elizabeth," declared Drake, "I claim this land for England, and I name it New Albion." He set up a fair great post, and to the post he fixed a plate of metal marked with the date and the name of the queen. So it was that the English paid their first visit to the western shores of what is now the United States. Then the Golden Hind crossed the Pacific. Drake fell among thievish savages. He ran upon a reef, and he was caught in fearful gales. But at last he sailed into Plymouth Sound, the first English captain who had been around the world. His enemies were waiting for the pirate, as they called him, and King Philip was clamoring for his punishment. But Queen Elizabeth would not give up either Drake or the treasure that he had brought. In a few months she went in all state to dine with him on board his vessel. Before she left, she made him a knight. Thousands of people visited the Golden Hind, and she forbade that it should ever be destroyed. The queen was in need of brave sailors. A few years later, Philip prepared a great fleet to attack England. He was so sure of victory that he called his fleet the Invincible Armada. 60 vessels had already assembled off Lisbon and Cadiz. Here was a chance for Drake. He set out with 4 of the queen's vessels and 26 provided by merchants. Everyone was eager to have a share in the enterprise, for wherever Drake went, he found treasure. He sailed straight for Cadiz, and before the Spaniards even guessed that their enemy was at hand, he was burning ships and destroying stores. This was all very well, but Drake did not mean to return to England empty-handed. He had heard that a Portuguese vessel with a precious cargo was near the Azores. He sailed out boldly, captured the ship, loaded his vessel with a greater treasure than ever before, and went home. He sent a gay little message to the queen that he had singed King Philip's beard. In reality, he had done so much harm to the Armada that it could not sail for a whole year. At last, however, the Armada came. The English had made the best preparations that they could, and their fleet lay off Plymouth. Drake and the other admirals were playing bowls on shore, when suddenly a man ran among them so out of breath that he could only gasp, "The Spaniards! The Spaniards! They are off the coast!" 2 of the officers started for their ships, but Drake called, "Gentlemen, let us go on with our game. There will be time enough to beat the Spaniards afterwards." The game was played out, and then the admirals went on board their vessels. The Spaniards had a great many stately, top-heavy ships that they called galleons. The English had a mongrel fleet made up of almost all the kind of craft that had ever been built. If they had been willing to stand still and be fired at, the Spaniards would probably have beaten. But a little English boat, hardly longer than a fishing smack, would dash up under the high guns of a galleon and fire a shot or two. Then, before the clumsy Spanish vessel could turn around, The English boat had slipped away and was firing at another great warship. Drake was the man of whom the Spaniards were most afraid. People believed in magic in those days, and many a man whispered, "He has sold himself to the devil, and Satan is helping him." They must almost have thought Drake to be Satan himself when they knew his next exploit. The English sent burning boats among the galleons. In their fright, the Spanish ships cut loose from their anchors and soon were widely separated. Then was Drake's time. He dashed up to one after another and captured it, and with 12 of the great vessels in tow, went back to the fleet. The winds and waves finished the work, and only 60 of Philip's ships ever went back to Spain. Drake made another expedition across the Atlantic in quest of treasure, but it failed. The Spaniards had learned better how to meet the dragon, as they called him, and they hid their riches more carefully. Sickness came upon the little company. Every day there were deaths. At last, Drake himself fell ill and grew worse rapidly. The face of the surgeon was grave, and the men gathered in groups to talk of the suffering admiral. "There will never be another man like him," they declared. "No," said one, "he never forgot his men, and when there was a prize, he gave us a generous share." "He was good to his prisoners, too," added another. "Any other man would have killed them, but he let them go free, and once he even gave them a vessel to go home in. He brought a stream of fresh water into Plymouth, and he and Sir John gave the Chatham chest to help poor sailors. He never would let a church be burned or the house of any woman that begged for mercy." So the men talked of their beloved commander. The fleet had anchored near the little island of Puertobello, and a few days later it sailed slowly out to sea, bearing the leaden coffin in which were the remains of the dead admiral. Trumpets were blown, cannons were fired, and then the body of the old hero was lowered solemnly and reverently into the ocean.